Well, good morning. It's good to be here, and all these happy, chirpy faces and happy, chirpy people. I remember Mark Chappell saying a long while ago that the June long weekend is the worst attended weekend of the year. So there you go. Look at all these people that have come along. Wally's the man over there to set out the chairs, and he is a man of great faith. And we're here this morning, and we've filled them up, basically. I have been given the privilege of speaking the second week on money, and you're thinking, oh no, oh no. Actually, last week, Tony did mention that it's not always easy, and it's not. I've, like you would do, I've struggled a little bit to prepare and to think about how to present this carefully and prayerfully, and of course, not wanting to impart guilt trips, but also recognising the fact that there's an awful lot said by Jesus and in the scriptures about money and resources and things like that, because we all, of course, know that it's an important aspect of our life. And I would think that in the last couple of weeks, we've all heard that there's the things that are happening in our economy and there's money involved in so many things and things are rising, and you think, wow, where's this going? So, I prayed a lot about this. And I'm actually a person that's part of this particular society. I've not grown up anywhere else. This is where I've lived and grown up. About 28 years ago, I was speaking to a group of ladies up in a leafy suburb of Sydney. And as I was talking to these ladies, I was there as a representative of a Bible society. I lasted 15 years in that job. I loved it. It was itinerancy. I travelled, I talked, and I met a lot of people. And I was telling these people that I'd been on a scholarship to China for 3 weeks. I didn't have to pay a thing. And I travelled with a travel agent from Sydney who spoke the language, and that I'd had the great privilege of travelling on the Dyson Murphy Scholarship. And a lady put up a hand and said, that was my husband. He put the money up when he died so that this scholarship would allow people who talked about what they were, talked about the Ministry of Bible Society, to travel to the places to actually see what happened. So you travel on my dead husband's interest. I was quite taken aback. But you know, when I was over there, there was a couple of things that I remember that really stuck in my mind and stand out, and I do remember. And one of those things was one night, I was taken to this little hotel. It wasn't very big. And about the third floor, I had about 2 hours with a guy, a little guy, I was going to say. He was small of stature, big of guts, but small of stature, who had spent 21 years in prison for his faith. His name was Alan Ewan, English name. Now, some of you would have read about him, some of you would know about him, but I must say, amazing story. I would say he suffered for his faith. And when I've read his story, and I've just read it quickly again this morning on what I could pick up very quickly on Google, his wife especially had 6 kids, one child policy hadn't come in at that stage. They suffered terribly. They were kicked out of their home on repeated occasions. They were poor, poor, poor paupers, and the government was repeatedly coming and harassing that particular family. But as I sat and listened to the bloke, and he could talk, and so could his wife, they didn't shut up. They were very contagious Christians, but they were suffering Christians. That's what stood out in my mind. Well, the passage that we're going to continue on with today, after 2 Corinthians chapter 8, is in the area of giving to suffering Christians, giving to poor Christians. And that's where we'll be taking up this morning as I continue on with this passage. Now, I haven't got a whiz-bang PowerPoint this morning because of the fact that it's a little bit like Goliath's armour for me. It doesn't always work. But there's a couple of things that I want to say as well. Now, this is not going up where I want it. I've got to... No, that's it. That's what I've got to do. I want to read a comment from a book that I've kept. Now, I threw a lot of books out because you don't need as many books as I did need, and I picked them up for nothing anyway off people that died and passed their libraries on. But I kept a series of books by John White. Now, some of you would remember John White. He was a psychiatrist, lived in Canada, but he was also a missionary. And he wrote books like The Fight, Eros Defiled, Eros Redeemed. And one of the books he's also got, and I've got in my library still, is Money Isn't God. Now, it's an intriguing book because I do remember that when I first read it a long while ago, he mentioned the Bible Society and some of the ways in which we raise funds he didn't think were good. And also, he also mentioned that rich Christians went to Israel too often and some of the things that happened over there weren't right, and I'd been to Israel too. I just remembered the book. It was kind of like a prophetic book. So I will read a little bit in here, and this leads us into, I hope, a little bit on the passage that we'll be looking at, and tithing in the Old Testament and giving in the New Testament, because that's what the passage tends to lead to. It's in chapter 11, and I'll be reading quite a slab, and then I'll be taking a fairly long reading, in fact, the whole chapter, from 2 Corinthians chapter 9. So you'll have to bear with me and listen. You won't be able to see this, but you'll be able to see the passage on the screen. So listen. For many years, we lived in a materialistic world divided by iron and bamboo curtains into two materialistic camps. Bearing in mind, this was written quite a few years ago. Those of capitalistic materialism and of communist materialism. To Christians in the West, the communist variety seemed infinitely more sinister. Under Western materialism, the church flourished and religious groups were not only free, but enjoyed tax concessions. Many churches were full. Superbly prepared literature grew in volume and sales. A missionary movement on an unprecedented scale had carried the gospel to all parts of the earth. Yet volume is no substitute for quality. In the other half of the world, where Christians were much less affected by the temptation of our kind of materialism, we found evidence of a spirit and a joy in spite of suffering, which made Western Christianity seem hollow. Christians in China, in Russia, in Eastern Europe, in Africa, in Cuba, lived lives of incredible heroism, and bore witness with gladness. Though they were beaten, imprisoned, vilified, and tortured, their joy rose unquenchable and their faith stood unshakable. We make a mistake when we glibly assert that what the Western church needs is persecution. We must be grateful for our freedom. The real explanation of the difference between underground churches of the East and showpiece churches of the West has to do with materialism. The transition from communism to capitalism in Eastern Europe during recent years surprised us with its ease. Looking beneath it all, however, to see why, the communists who were already materialists simply adopted the capitalist form. Communist materialism is doctrinaire and oppressive capitalism materialism, which I earlier defined as the idea that makes matter all that matters. It's pragmatic and it's cancerous. And he goes across the page and he talks about the fact often we're torn with our materialism and what we find in our climate here. Now, the social climate of Jesus' time. If we are to interpret accurately Jesus' teaching about material wealth, we must have some idea of the social context in which he spoke about it. Dick France discusses the matter in Third Way magazine. The socio-economic situation of the time of Jesus is vividly illustrated by several of his parables. They reveal a sharply cross-structured society, class-structured society, with landowners, stewards, tenant farmers, day labourers and slaves. It was a situation in which the few could dress in purple and fine linen and feast sumptuously every day while beggars sat at the gates where capital steadily accumulated in the lands of the rich, while the ordinary free man lived under the threat of slavery from debt. France quotes an estimate that because of the double burden of religious dues and Roman taxes and total taxation was about 40%, and it would be exacted from an average income, not including unjust exactions of local tax collectors. Two things interest him: the social background of Jesus and his followers, and the chosen lifestyle they adopted. The social background appears to have been middle class. Joseph, the earthly father of Jesus, ran a carpentry business and might have even employed workers. Matthew was a tax collector. Peter, James, and John had shares in a boat and fishing equipment for their fishing enterprise. They too may have employed extra hands. Other followers included the wife of Herod's steward and women who provided for them out of their means. Joseph was far from wealthy, indicated by his offering of two turtle doves rather than a lamb at Jesus' presentation at the temple, but he was a long way from being at the bottom of the economic ladder. The lifestyle Jesus adopted, and which he inherited his disciples to adopt, involved a renunciation, or at least a forsaking, of any private property other than the clothes they all wore daily, and a dependence on God to supply their needs through the generosity of the people to whom they ministered. They received food and lodging on the journeys, may have been more especially indebted to people such as Lazarus, Martha and Mary, and probably received gifts of money from time to time, though there is no record of their ever soliciting funds. What they possessed, they seemed to share in common, Judas taking care of the distribution. From their meager resources, they probably still gave to the poor. The protest against the waste of the ointment poured on the Lord's feet implied that giving to the poor was their practice. Their chosen lifestyle raises a number of questions. Was it intended to be a model for all followers of Jesus? Was it perhaps a model for full-time workers? Are there two classes of followers of Jesus? Those who forsake all and live a hand-to-hand existence as though they serve him, and those who supply such workers from their capital and income. There can be no question that during the New Testament period, Christians adopted no universal economic practice. Many early Christians sold their goods and shared with others in the church at Jerusalem. It does not seem to have been expected that the practice should be universal. Now, this is a bit here I want to share as we go on. Many scholars seem to suggest that the generous sharing in Jerusalem was occasioned by the hardship of those who had come from a great distance for the Feast of Pentecost and had been converted and had stayed on. Others point to the probable poverty of even local converts. The action of the Jerusalem church is often criticised by modern Christians who feel that the subsequent appeals to other churches would not have been necessary had the rash generosity of the wealthier Christians had been more temperate. It would have been better, they feel, to have been less generous and to have encouraged more industry. Now, we're coming to a passage now which actually mentions and talks about the collection for the poor in Jerusalem. This is 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Now, what had actually happened, as you remember, was that there was a famine in the area of Judea that was talked about. Agabus was a prophet. He prophesied that that was to take place. And probably, as this talks about here, there was things that happened in Jerusalem that contributed to the poverty there. And Paul knew about it, and he got to the churches that were in the surrounding areas, this time Achaia, and this time also the churches that we would call modern Greece, and asked them to support the poor people in Jerusalem. So that's where we sit today. That's the passage. That's the setting for the passage, the message that I've got for you today. Now, because they've asked me to speak this morning, and this is basically about giving, this is basically settling in on this passage, and we're looking at giving, in its context, it's giving to the poor, but this is a general message about our giving and what we can learn about this giving. Now, let's go back to the Old Testament a little bit. It's fair to say that the Old Testament economy was a theocracy, at least for some period of time. It was, they were answerable directly to the Lord, theos and government, at least for some period of time. But then there were agents as well, there was priests, and it was not always particularly successful, but that's the way it was. We're no longer under the theocracy. They were really anarchy for a while too, but they never were a democracy like we are. So the question was, or do we live in exactly the same way as them? Well, of course, we don't actually live exactly that way. I suppose you could say that the tithe in the Old Testament was essentially a taxation. It almost added up to about 25%. In fact, some have suggested it was even more than that. It was for the upkeep of, if you like, the government of the time, the Jewish people. There was essentially at least three tithes. The first one was the tithe for the Levites. Now, the Levites were the ones who didn't have any property in the land. You remember when they came in to settle the land? There was the tribes by lot were given a portion of land, but the Levites didn't get a portion. They were to look after, they were to service the tabernacle and the temple. So that was the first tithe. But I want you to also note that in that particular situation, the tithe was of food and it was of livestock. It was grain and livestock. The other people who didn't actually tithe, they didn't have crops. The crops were things that could be eaten. The meal, the food, the livestock were things that could be eaten. Now, to bring it to Jerusalem, which was the storehouse, and that's where it was to be the food for the priests, the food for the Levites. But the Levites actually had to tithe off the tithe. That's what's been called the second tithe, so that the priests, who were technically distinct from the Levites, also had enough to eat. That's why you read in Malachi chapter 3 that they were to bring in the full tithe into the storehouse so that there was food to eat, so that the priests could eat. And by the way, it was something that was enabled, it was something that God could act increase to. So there was curses if they didn't, and there was blessings if they did, and God would supply the rain, and then there would be the increase through the grain and through the well-fed stock. Then there was also, there was a third tithe, that was a tithe for the festivals. Now you remember that the Israelites were expected, at least every male, was expected three times a year to attend three festivals. They were in Jerusalem, that was the place where the Lord had placed his name, you couldn't do it anywhere else. And then you would celebrate Passover, First Fruits or Pentecost and Tabernacles. Now it was like a party time. You would come along, and you could eat, drink, and be merry if you like. You could even drink alcoholic beverage. And actually, it had to be at Jerusalem. If you lived in a far-off place, you had to substitute what you were going to bring, like your cattle or your livestock or your grain, for money. Then you would bring your money, and then you would exchange it when you got back to Jerusalem. And then you enjoyed this party-like atmosphere and this feast unto the Lord. It was a time of fellowship. It was a time of rejoicing. It was a time to rejoice and enjoy all the good things that God has given the people. Plus the symbolic or the meanings of what God was doing through his people. Then the fourth one was the tithe for the poor. Every 3 years, and by the way, the Jews had a 7-year cycle, but every 3 years, so every third and sixth year, there was a tithe or a 10%, that's what the tithe means. There was a 10% of the grain and the livestock for the poor. Also, they weren't supposed to actually go right round to the edges of the fields. They kind of were supposed to harvest a circle in their field if it was square. So they left around the edges the things for the poor, the leftovers for the poor. So like the book of Ruth talks about, you could come in and you could glean. You could come in and you could take things if you were poor. Jesus actually mentions that in the New Testament as well. And I suppose in a sort of a sense, there's something about that. There's a principle involved in sharing with the poor as you come over into the New Testament. Now, I suppose the question is, and there's a lot of differences of opinion on this, and I suppose I have to sort of say where I feel we need to come down on in this area. What did Jesus say about tithing in particular? Did Jesus say that Christians are mandated to give 10% of their income or more? And Jesus mentioned tithing three times. Two of them were talking about the one thing, where the Pharisees were tithing, but incorrectly. Of course, what we need to remember was that was during an era when actually the temple was still in vogue. The temple was still there. The Pharisees were expected to tithe. Jesus said that they tithed everything, dill and cumin. So they're pedantic about the small things, but forgot all about the big things, the things of justice and the things about mercy. Jesus said, you should have done both. You should have tithed, okay, but you should have also remembered mercy. But this was still in the era of the Jewish economy. Now, at that time, and up until AD 70, there was a temple. There were sacrifices. There was a high priest. There were priests. That economy was going on. Although, of course, when Jesus died, it was basically finished, but it didn't totally die out until AD 70 when Titus came in and destroyed the temple. But you know, what we suppose we need to understand, and I'm going somewhere with this, is that there was a change in covenant. There was a new covenant came into vogue. The new covenant. In the old covenant, the high priest has been now replaced by Christ as our high priest. We are all now priests in the sense that we can come and draw nigh to God by straight access to him. We don't need to offer bloody sacrifices. The New Testament tells us we offer the sacrifice of our lips to the Lord. We don't have an altar in church. Christ was sacrificed on the altar once and for all, Hebrews tells us. And the other thing is, technically speaking, of course, we don't have a temple. It says in John 4 that the Holy Spirit, God doesn't dwell in temple made with hands. We are the temple. This is just the building. We are the temple individually and corporately. So there has been a change. And it's no longer necessary for those things to actually... we need to understand that as we come into this reading. Give it a setting as we come into 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Now, I'd like to take a reading, and it'll come up on the screen, and it's from the Message. Now, don't crucify me too much about the Message. I've been reading a lot of the translations this week. There's a couple of good things in this passage from the Message that stand out that I think give us the New Covenant, the New Testament understanding of giving. And I'd like to read to you. Now, bearing in mind the background to this, as was mentioned last week, that the church here in Corinth was gifted in many ways, but Paul wanted them to be very gifted in the gift of giving. He wanted them to be generous. And he reminds them that they'd started a year before to put aside money for the poor in Jerusalem, but he wanted them to bring it to completion. And he was using the example of the Macedonians. They were actually in Achaia. The Macedonians, who gave out of extreme poverty and gave extremely well, using them, boasting about them, and pushing these people forward to actually complete the giving that they'd started 12 months ago. Let's have a look. If I wrote any more of the relief offering for the poor Christians, I'd be repeating myself. I know you're on board and ready to go. I've been bragging about you through Macedonia, the province, telling them, Achaia province has been ready to go on this since last year. Your enthusiasm by now has spread to most of them. Now I'm sending the brothers to make sure you're ready. You remember last week, Tony said to us these were trustworthy people. They were people that could be trusted with finances. So my bragging won't turn out to be just so much hot air. If some Macedonians and I happened to drop in on you and found you weren't prepared, we'd all be pretty red-faced, you and us, for acting so sure of ourselves. So to make sure there will be no slip-up, I've recruited these brothers as an advance team to get you and your promised offering all ready before I get there. I want you to have all the time you need to make this offering in your own way. I don't want anything forced or hurried at the last minute. Now remember, in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, there's mention of storing up on the first day of the week an offering. Remember, I like this. This is why I've put the message in. A stingy planter gets a stingy crop. A lavish planter gets a lavish crop. I want each of you to take plenty of time to think it over and make up your own mind what you will give. That will protect you against sob stories and arm twisting. God loves it when the giver delights in the giving. God can pour on the blessings in astonishing ways so that you're ready for anything and everything, more than just ready to do what needs to be done, as one psalmist puts it. Now, I looked up this psalm again last night, and the psalm talks about a person who is well off and who can actually afford and is affording and is generous to those that are poor. And then this is the quotation. I really like it in this particular passage in the message. It says, I like the way he puts it. As one psalmist puts it, he throws caution to the winds, giving to the needy in reckless abandon. His right living, right giving ways never run out, never wear out. This most generous God who gives seed to the farmer that becomes bread for your meals is more than extravagant with you. He gives you something you can then give away, which grows into full-formed lives, robust in God, wealthy in every way, so that you can be generous in every way, producing with us great praise to God. Carrying out that social relief work involves far more than helping meet the bare needs of poor Christians. It also produces abundant and bountiful thanksgivings to God. This relief offering is a prod to live at your very best, showing your gratitude to God by being openly obedient to the plain meaning of the message of Christ. You show your gratitude through your generous offerings to your needy brothers and sisters and really toward everyone. Meanwhile, moved by the extravagance of God in your lives, you'll respond by praying for you in passionate intercession for whatever you need. Thank God for this gift, his gift. No language can praise it enough. Now, as far as I can see, that really says an awful lot about it. That is a really, really encouraging passage about giving. Now, this is the main passage that the New Testament talks about giving in. The main passage. Now, what are the things? Well, you'd expect me to have a PowerPoint here, but I couldn't get it together. It didn't look fancy enough this morning, so I'm giving you my points. I expect you to remember them, so see how you go. Now, the first thing I want you to try and remember, and I'm watching my time, I'm not too far out, is we are to give ourselves. Give ourselves. Now, if you look back into chapter 8, the Macedonians, who the scripture actually talks about, were very poor and were suffering, gave out of extreme poverty. Look, to be honest, I've never given out of extreme poverty. I haven't. This is why it's hard for me to preach this message. But it says in chapter 8 and verse 5 that they gave themselves first. And, you know, if we're going to be a contagious Christian and we're going to be a giving Christian, then the first thing I suppose we have to do is give of ourselves first, let's face it. We have to realise that we don't own anything. We'd be dead tomorrow. And, of course, where does it go? And we can store up stuff, and let's face it, we do in this culture. Stewardship, we don't own it, we steward it so that we can pass it on and give it and share it with other people. whether it's people in your home or whether it's taking people or giving people or giving into the church, all those kind of things. Give yourself first so that we can be giving people. The second thing I've noted here is give thoughtfully and purposefully. It's not just sort of a matter of, well, oh, gee, the bag's coming around or the plate's coming around. Oh, I forgot. You know, I'll pull out whatever it is and throw it in. It's not really like that. 1 Corinthians chapter 16 says, you know, store it up, think about it. And I don't want collections when I come. Do it as you go along. It's not just ad hoc stuff. It's a thoughtful, purposeful thing. You get that in 9 and verse 7 too. It's something you've got to think about. And number three, it's give willingly and cheerfully. That's in verse number 7 too. It's a little bit hard with this, but it talks about the fact that you will give it cheerfully and you'll give it hilariously. I looked up the Greek word last night. I'm a Greek scholar, I'm certainly not that, but I can use other people's resources. Giving willingly, yes, we don't want to give because we're told to give. It's willing outflow of our heart. But to give cheerfully, there's nothing worse than someone who doesn't want to give. They just drag it out of them. It's kind of hilarious giving. That's the word. You look up the Greek word that's behind cheerful, it's hilarious. I mean, hilarious is not bad, is it? A hilarious giving. You ever done hilarious giving? It's hilarious giving. Not just boring giving, hilarious giving, cheerful giving. Four, generously. We can be stingy. I mean, there are stingy Christians, let's face it. I mean, you don't want to be a stingy Christian. Nobody really knows if you're stingy or not except you. But you know, we don't want to be stingy Christians, eh? Generous with what God's given us. We've probably all got too much, actually, in a sort of a sense. We live in a culture that's got a lot of stuff. And I've even got golf clubs. I mean, who has golf clubs around the world? I mean, who's rich enough to play on a golf course? I mean, they don't do it much in Kenya, do they? Generously. Give away your golf club. I remember I did give away a golf club. Mark's life, I did give away a golf club once. I'd saved up money to buy a real expensive golf club. I felt bad about it because I went and visited the guy down in... I had been given this. This wasn't in my notes, but there was a guy down in Richmond who smoked too much, drank too much, and he had a lot of stuff going on in his life. But I was asked to visit him, so I went down and I felt quite sad for this guy. And I had this money in my wallet that I'd saved up to get a better driver. First world problem. And I thought, oh, the Lord said, you give him the money. So I gave him the money. Then I go away and I thought, now I haven't got a good driver. So, anyway, I'm still a hacker anyway. So giving generously. Number five, give in keeping with your income, proportionately. That's what Paul says. That's open-ended, isn't it? I mean, I know people who give 90% of their income away. I mean, they've got to be rich, let's face it. I mean, you think about it, I mean, whoa. But they've trusted God and they've allowed God the increase, and he's been God after all, and he's allowed God to increase their giving. And with a heart for him, it's happened. And then, you know, when you look at this sowing imagery, it looks like it's increase. If you don't sow stingily, God's able to give the increase. I mean, this is not a prosperity doctrine. There's a certain truth in that whole scenario. But God knows. He's not stupid. And he can multiply, and increase is what he does. So all of us need to be aware that increase is God's stuff. And we give, and you can never really outgive God. I had an old mate who used to tell me, you know, if you're shoveling out, God shovels back in sometimes, and he's got a bigger shovel. Now, it's fitting to love, care for, pray for and fund the New Testament community. Let's face it. I mean, electricity. They've got buildings, electricity and chairs and all the stuff that comes together needs to be paid for. It doesn't come out of the blue. And we need to be aware of that. And then what else do we find mentioned in the New Testament? Well, those that live off the gospel. And there's many of them. In fact, there's some here today. Many are living off the gospel, whether it's local pastors, whether it's overseas missionaries. Then you've got them mentioned again in, well, 1 Corinthians 9 and 2 John. Those that didn't take anything from the Gentiles, they needed to be looked after, John said. Leaders who labour in word and doctrine, 1 Timothy chapter 5. And then I suppose you could say those that are in need of clothing and food, James. Yeah. Widows and orphans, James again. Well, the poor, and that's what we've been looking at today. It's interesting, too, in the Old Testament, the poor received the gifts. And actually, when Jesus talked about the widow who gave the two mites, he also said that just about that time that the Pharisees were devouring widows' houses. Anyway, can I encourage you, because this is really got to me looking at this week about my own giving. It has. I tell you no lie. You wouldn't think I'd tell you a lie anyway, would you? But how's our heart? Are we really generous? Can we increase our generosity? Can we trust God? Is he fair dinkum? Is God fair dinkum after all? Or is he playing around with some sort of game and guilt trip job? Yeah. Test. Try him. Although we're maybe not working under Old Testament principles yet, we've got a God who's abundant. The New Testament God is abundant and generous and wants us to give. Debbie and I had a long talk about this yesterday, whether I should share this, because sometimes people can get the wrong impressions when you tell stories. They form opinions. You probably formed opinions about me anyway, whether you like me or not. Some do, some don't. Yeah, some do, some don't. But I like to hear about other people giving sometimes. The story I tell you is not in any sense to talk about. It's not to talk about proportions or anything. It's just the joy of giving. You know, when I have people come to our small group and they bring cakes every week and they've cooked them themselves, they're happy, they're joyful. It's big time stuff. When people cook to put in down there, I'm thinking of people like I'm looking at you right now, they cook and they put it in the freezer down there. There's joy in that, isn't there? Come on, be honest. There's a joy in that. And when somebody does something for someone or sends something for people or brings it in, puts it in the offering every week and supports your local church, there's a joy in that. There's a joy in that. That's God stuff. And just tell you this, just as a sort of encouragement. I did talk to Debbie about it, so I'm not doing this on my own. This is in my notes. Years ago, we were going to another church. And this is about joy, by the way. And there was this lady there, and she was hard done by. We had a fair bit to do with her. And she was in business with her husband, and their accountant had cooked the books. He had two books going, and they lost everything. I lost a lot. I'm serious. I lost everything. I lost everything. And then he took off with another woman, so she was left like a shag on a rock. Three kids to support, and no money whatsoever, and a claptrap of a car, and a hairy little dog that looks like it was going to die. And anyway, it's generally giving stuff in our family comes from Debbie. Debbie comes along to me one day and she says, oh, I'd like to get this lady a car. So I'm thinking, yeah, no, we'll find some little car, give her the car. And Debbie says, I really think we should get her a new car. And I said, well, fat chance we are doing that. We haven't got no money at all. She said, well, no, I'm going to borrow the money for this lady. I said, really? So Debbie said, well, go and get a we'll go and get a loan. We'll borrow the money. Now, look, I'm not, this has nothing to do with all that. I'm just, wait for the end of the story. And anyway, went and borrowed the money, took out a personal loan, went down and told her we wanted to meet her at McDonald's. So it turns up at McDonald's at Blacktown. Didn't tell her what was doing, having a cup of coffee with her. So we get there and had a cup of coffee and said, now, we've just got something we'd like to share with you, something we'd like to show you. Still didn't tell her what it was, if I remember correctly. So we'd been down, we'd paid for this brand new car, got it wrapped up in a big ribbon, if I remember correctly, and took this lady down. She didn't know what in all the world it was, turned up at this place, walked in and said, there's your car. Now, she got a buzz out of it. I know she did, because she gave this thing a name straight away. It was like Hokey Pokey or some little name. And she drove off into the distance with this car. Now, you know, that was an enormous amount of joy in that, to see that there was a widow, who had a car that went for quite a few years, a lot of years actually. And my point is, there was a lot of joy in that. There's the same joy you see and we see when we're giving all these other ways, smaller or larger. I played golf with a guy the other day who gave me golf membership, by the way. He paid for it. Who had a guy that stood up in church and was wanting to fund a school building in India. So this guy goes up after and said, I've got a lot of money. I'd like to donate. So, yeah, well, he could. It was within his situation. So guess what happened? You donated it to this school. And he said, well, why didn't you come and open it? So they jumped on an airplane, shot over to India, basically supported the whole thing, cut the ribbon, and flew back. And I was sitting in a golf club the other day thinking, gee, first world problem, sitting in a golf club. But this bloke wouldn't shut up showing me what he was doing. And he was so happy what he did. Now, admittedly, he's loaded, but he's insanely generous too. I know other things. But, you know, there's a joy in that. So get in on the joy. Whether it's giving away the cards that people give away down at Redbank, or whether it's anything you do, there's a joy in it. I'm finished. I've got a long while. Thank you. Amen. Praise God.